into sports.
20 yards out, Hurst to shoot. Don't shoot! Oh, what a goal from Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah. No.
Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports, ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your app store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network, with Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural, protein-powered chicken bites.
Now you're welcome along to the Huddle Breakdown podcast. We are the podcast to look at the stats, XG and performance of Celtic FC. There's a lot to get into this week, as always is the case with Celtic these days, but we're going to start off with the main topic of the week, the Dubai trip. So 13 players forced to self-isolate after Christopher Julian tests positive on return from Dubai. 13 first team players plus Neil Lennon and assistant John Kennedy as well. Celtic's statement summed up in one paragraph for me: whilst we were in Dubai, the announcements made on January 4th significantly changed the COVID landscape. The reality is that the case could have well occurred if we remained in Scotland, as other cases have done in Scotland and across UK sport in the past week. Nicola Sturgeon came out hard against Celtic, criticising them, saying that she didn't think that they were sticking to the proper protocols. Peter Lull announced yesterday in a statement, if you look back over the last 4 years, going to the camp in Dubai has been extremely successful and the decisions made were entirely in the best interest of the team and the best interests of the club. What we planned to do was take them to the same facilities, which are world class, and after a hectic program in November and December, which was had proven to be a great benefit to the team and their performance in January, to get to that performance level again. Jucco James and Alan Morrison are on the line to discuss all of this. Lads, I think the general feeling that I'm getting from all this is that Celtic have washed their hands of any responsibility for this at all and are essentially playing their cards in the sense that this could have happened in Scotland and we had permission to be there. So technically, we're not wrong in being there.
Yeah. So there's like a million things we can touch on here in terms of issues, but for me, there are a couple I'm going to kind of cover really, which fundamentally call into question in my mind the basic competency of the board. So when your board of directors, actually, it doesn't matter whether we're managing Topshop or HSBC or Celtic Football Club, right? The roles and responsibilities of that board are pretty much the same, right? That's why you have non-exec directors that can be pretty fungible, move and operate and oversee activities on different organisations, because fundamentally, the workings of a board and the work and the considerations of a board are broadly similar in across many and all industries really, and one of the skills or competencies that you need as a board member and as a CEO is you really are the kind of moral compass of the firm. And to touch on the point you made, sometimes because you can do something doesn't mean to say that you should. So because you've got sign off from the regulator to do something, you know, you still have to ask yourself, is this the right thing to do for all of our stakeholders, for our brand, for our reputation, and for the benefit of the firm and the society that we operate in? Because no company is an island. You know, this does. The impact that you're having on society, especially for a football club, which is ingrained within in society, these considerations are very important. And it fundamentally comes down to this. It wasn't the right thing to do. And the board fundamentally didn't come to that conclusion. Now, and this question of, oh, well, you know, in the 4th of January, the situation changed, won't wash at all, because any company, especially in the current situation, we'd have some kind of COVID crisis response, framework to put in place. Now, for example, you know, the company I work for, we had daily executive level meetings when the whole thing kicked off in March last year. And then, of course, you know, as you sort yourselves out, that cadence becomes less frequent. But I would have thought that for most companies, and certainly for Celtic, you would have some kind of at least weekly crisis response group meeting to say, you know, what is the latest situation? Because things are changing very quickly. You know, Peter Lowell in his interview yesterday touched on the fact that, yeah, well, we got approval in November, you know, so, you know, but the point being is you're constantly reviewing those decisions to say, you know, has the world changed? Has the landscape changed? Have the risks changed? And I'll come on to risks in a moment. And fundamentally, they had. You know, the situation was getting worse. You know, all the signs were that, you know, lockdown restrictions were going to get worse. So although the approval was there, you know, you've got to read the environment that you live in, and that is a key competency of the board. And they got it wrong, right? They got it wrong. And you know, this comment about Celtic is the most impacted club, you know, he's actually probably right. He's right if you look through the lens of financial. If you look through the financial lens, Celtic have probably lost more money than any other club. However, that doesn't mean to say they're the most impacted. It only means they're the most impacted through that lens. And that lens is hardly surprising given that Lowell's an accountant. I don't really like accountants being CEOs, but here we are. It does happen. but there's a whole range of other lenses that as a board member and as a director you have to look at, including, you know, not just financial. So let me come on to the second thing, and this really worries me massively, which is, you know, the whole concept of risk management. Right? Risk management should exist in any company. Now, you may not be like a massive bank, a football club. It doesn't have a whole risk department and an army of people considering every individual risk competency. But nevertheless, it's a responsibility of the board to consider those risks. And really, it's a pretty standard framework. You think about what is it that could go wrong that is going to impact us? What's the likelihood of it going wrong? And if it does go wrong, what's the impact? And then finally, what are we going to do to mitigate it? Which could range from a whole host of issues, a whole host of measures, like we have done, no doubt, at training, where, you know, to combat the risk of players getting COVID, there'll be all sorts of measures put in place to mitigate those risks. To on the other hand, you know, doing nothing and just waiting to see, and this comment that, oh, you know, we have all these protocols in place to deal with player training and contact and so forth. You're going to a completely different environment, okay? You're mass transporting a large group of people over many, many hours. It's an 8-hour flight to Dubai, right? You're mass transporting people. The players don't live together. They probably don't travel to work together, but now they will be. Mm-hmm. They're in the building, you know, 24/7 together. When at home, they're not. The physical layout of the campus and of the training facilities will be fundamentally different. Celtic have control over all the ancillary staff at Lennox Town, you know, from the gate person to the grounds people to the catering staff to the masseurs to whatever. And that won't be the case in Dubai. You might get a bit of paper with a stamp on it saying, you know, certified COVID, you know, but fundamentally your risk profile has gone up massively. Mm-hmm. And also the risk profile is changing, you know, over time, as I mentioned. So this statement about, oh, with the benefit of hindsight, as if to say, well, it's all very well saying after the fact, but actually, if you were a risk manager and you were looking at, you know, going to Dubai and you were saying, okay, well, what are the possible outcomes here? I would have thought that even as a layperson, that the risk of one person contacting COVID would be significantly high. And actually, what has happened here isn't even the highest risk that could have happened. I would have said what has actually happened, where one person has become infected and then a corollary of around, you know, 15 people have been locked down because of that, would have been probably a medium risk. You know, it would have been pretty likely, actually, to have happened. Mm-hmm. You know, the worst case scenario would have been the complete shutdown of football operations. And we probably weren't too far from that in all honesty. So what level of risk management? And risk management isn't a one-time deal. I'm going to assess my risks, because as I mentioned before, within the framework of, you know, a board operating under these conditions, you should be reviewing these things on a weekly basis, saying, has the landscape changed? Has the guidance changed? Has the risk profile changed? Is it now more likely? And you'd looked at that, you'd have come to the conclusion, well, yes, it has. The situation is worsening. Is it really worth it? Mm-hmm. And then you've got to consider, what is the impact? What is the worst that could happen? What would be the financial impact of that? What would be the impact on our brand and on our reputation? Based on the things he said, these things don't seem to have even been considered. I mean, if you'd said, okay, we've done all this, and we concluded, we're going to take the risk anyway and see what happens, you'd kind of think, well, at least you've thought about it and you've made a decision. I don't think they even thought about this.
Yeah.
The comments they've made, there's no evidence. And then finally, you know, the aftermath of it, as you mentioned, the whole lack of self-awareness is just, it's just baffling from a, you know, from a sort of PR perspective. It's just absolutely awful. But fundamentally for me, I mean, James will no doubt pull up another 20 reasons why the board are incompetent, but those are the two for me that just absolutely scream. Just basic, fundamental, what you need a director to do for any company.
James, your thoughts on all this?
So the Alan eloquently referenced the risk side of the equation. And I think I agree 100% there. And actually, when I went on Celtic Underground back at the end of July, you know, I talked a lot about, you know, Scott Brown at the time as a proxy for the analytical shortcomings that appeared to be on the horizon for the club. But somewhere last quarter of the podcast, I talked a lot about risk and how the composition of factors that were aligning for the season increased risk dramatically. And I think, you know, most human beings think in linear terms. So it's not natural for people to think in exponential math. That's why the pandemic has been so hard for people to grasp at times, which is, you know, how do we go from, you know, five people having cases and then three weeks later, countries are in complete lockdown because it's spread so fast. And so that's when you think about system dynamics and complex systems in particular, nonlinearity is a huge component to that. And what Alan just talked about on the risk side, that's the perfect example of that, where one person gets it and the you know, you make one decision, and because of the nonlinearity of the risk, not only do you have then 13 people, which could have been worse, you know, isolating, you now have the feedback loop of financial risk that Alan talked about, which again, if you look at financial risk and operating leverage in a structure financially, that's nonlinear for the most part. It can be anyway, meaning that, you know, if Celtic's season ticket renewals go from 50,000 to 35,000, the impact of that on cash flow is huge, right? We all of a sudden go from, you know, player wage baseline of 32 million to maybe 18 million, right? Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily proportional. So the risk side, I agree with 100% with Alan. It's been a disaster all season. But what makes this worse in my mind is when you talk about risk, you usually also talk about reward, right? What's your unit of risk relative to the upside? And this comes back to the analytical competency or lack thereof, which is, you know, this Hail Mary that a Dubai trip is the reason why we've outperformed relative to expectations post winter break in the last four seasons. And I tweeted about this, I think it was yesterday, the day before. It's like, what, you know, I haven't done it, but you probably very simply do an analysis, a regression analysis of other clubs' wage budgets relative to their league, squad size, that type of thing. You know, it only makes sense naturally that a club like Aberdeen, whose squad size and relative quality of that squad size is going to suffer as the season goes on due to injuries, due to workload, fatigue. And we saw that with Rangers last year, right? So that's, I actually did it on Alan's website back in, on Celtic by Numbers back in June, which was looking at the factors of what really drove Rangers falling off a cliff in results post winter break. And a lot of it had to do with the lack of squad depth. They had a cluster of injuries that they hadn't had in the first half of the season. And all of a sudden they had four or five, you know, of their most important players get injured. And so, and you know, when you have a deeper...
Sorry, Jen. Morella stopped scoring and they didn't have an adequate backup option, didn't have that depth.
Yeah. Exactly. And Defoe was injured then. Mm. And you had Jack get hurt and you had Davis get hurt and Barisic get... I mean, you had, you know, some of their better players get injured, whereas I think before break it was just... the one winger, I forget his name even, that went out with the red card. So, you know, to me, that's this goes back to the modeling of and how do you really attribute performance and think about things analytically. And so is there some impact? Of course. It's like the conversation we've had in the past about leadership and you know, on the pitch and that type of thing. Of course, there has an impact. The question is, how do you measure it? Can you measure it? But more importantly, is it, you know, 20% of performance? Is it 50% of performance? What's, you know, if you're doing an attribution analysis, how do you attribute certain things to what drives performance? I would argue that the Dubai trip is a rounding error as to why the season played out the way it did the last few seasons post-break. And it was vast, you know, for example, last season, it was far more important that they switched McGregor into an attacking eight role and gave Edouard a strike partner than they got some vitamin D while in Dubai.
Yeah, which you can get in tablet form. So you can
exactly that. Yeah. So the upside here was a Hail Mary. It was based off of a false premise that this was some magical way that we perform better is to get a week in the sun, or, you know, in prior seasons, 2 weeks in the sun. So when you put those two things together, it's just amazing. I keep coming back to this every time we talk about these issues, which it's just amazing the degree with which some of these decisions have been formulated and implemented and mishandled. You know, the ramifications of this are still to come. We, you know, this is going to continue to cascade the ramifications from the sequencing of bad decisions. It's just incredible that this decision was made, given the context of everything else that's going on.
Yeah, it was absolutely insane. And I suppose looking at it from even just a footballing perspective, first of all, 19 points behind, like what Peter Law was saying, that we did it in previous years, 19 points behind, you do not go to Dubai and go on a holiday and magically think that's going to change your season around. You're 19 points behind for a reason, because you're underperforming all of the different elements that we've talked about. Also, something that you touched on, Alan, that I wanted to touch on was the leadership. And how many people do you think this decision would have had to go through in order for it to happen? So you have the board, you definitely have Peter Lawle involved in that, maybe Dermot Desmond, Neil Lennon, John Kennedy, and all of them. Either nobody disagreed with going to Dubai, or nobody had the guts to stand up to whoever had the ultimate choice of going to Dubai to say that we're 19 points behind Rangers. There's a global pandemic going on. The fans are already protesting outside of the stadium. Maybe this is not a good idea. And then the implications of all of this, like you said, the risk management, the ultimate risk for this is that, for example, let's say, because we've seen a little bit of different variations of results coming out from these tests and false positives, false negatives, all sorts of things. What happens if Celtic come back from this trip? Christopher Julian never tests positive. He gets a false negative test. He plays in that game against Hibs. Hibs all get COVID. Celtic all get COVID. And the entire season is over. That is what was at stake here. And that could have happened.
Yeah, I agree with you. That is a scenario that you've described that is not unreasonable. It's not a you know, the moon crashes into the earth type of piece of risk management. It's actually a plausible scenario. And like you say, and as James eloquently said, what is the upside to this? Is it worth the risk, essentially? And in terms of the decision making, you know, again, I keep coming back to the board of directors have got very specific duties and responsibilities. So this isn't a decision for Neil Lennon, for John Kennedy. They've got a view. They're a key stakeholder as far as Lawle's concerned. Desmond's a key stakeholder, obviously, but this is a board member decision. This is these aspects of risk management are the responsibility of the CEO, the finance director, the head of operations, etc., the head of HR or what have you. Head of HR, actually, I would have expected to have been making quite a lot of noises and have been very aware and scenario planning around exactly the things that you've mentioned, by the way.
Yeah. One thing to learn is that the HR do not work for the people. They work for the company. So if the company make the decision, the HR department might raise a few concerns about it, but ultimately the company makes the choice. Let's get into the actual footballing things, because it seems like forever that we've been actually able to talk about what's going on the pitch as opposed to what's going on off the pitch. So Celtic 1, Hibernian 1, late goal from Nesbitt to level it up after David Turnbull had given Celtic the lead from a fantastic free kick, you have to say. Celtic's lineup, I got a lot of stick on YouTube for referring to it as a B team, but I suppose maybe I was being a little bit flippant with that. But Hazard in goals, Duffy, Sorrow, Turnbull, Roderick Johnson, Frimpong, McGregor, Harper, Welsh and Laxalt. So, you know, not the worst team in the world, to be honest. But let's get into things. Another set piece. What's going on?
Well, I think, you know, for that particular set piece, you know, I looked at it and I'm not being smart with hindsight here. As soon as Laxalt made that foul, my heart sank. I honestly did. And then you looked at it and you had effectively like a bunch of 11-year-olds lined up across the 6-yard box. And you're sort of thinking, this doesn't look good. So whether that particular set piece is a very good example to make generalizations about the season, I'm not so sure. But, you know, I think this game, go back to, you know, picking up on James's theme there of, you know, what's the upside. A tiny, tiny upside to this is that some players are going to get, you know, some exposure and some chances that otherwise wouldn't. And we might actually learn something. And we might actually save some money on maybe, you know, a couple of players breaking through that hitherto, you know, hitherto wouldn't. But, you know, I know you said, you know, this was still a strong squad. And on paper, it does look like a strong team that was put out there. But this, I think this goes to highlight how fragile and how complex a football team system actually is, that you only need to have a couple of adverse selection problems, like, for example, playing with no striker.
In a two-striker system.
And then, well, I actually wasn't sure what formation they were. I'll be honest with you, I still, having watched it twice now, I couldn't tell you what formation they were playing.
Agreed.
But it also highlights how fragile Celtic's squad actually is to stand up to any sort of challenge. Hibs are not a good side, as we've talked about on this podcast a while. The rest of the SPFL outside of one club who've had to cut their cloth accordingly because of the situation that everybody's in are all weaker than they were last season. You know, some teams like Livingston or Ross County, it was a bad example, but might be like a tiny bit. You could probably make a case for saying they've improved a wee bit, but in terms of challenging Celtic, you know, this would have been like a free ride. Beat Rangers pretty much, and you'd have wrapped it up. So Hibs are not a great team. But yeah, you know, you could see that it took Celtic at least 20 minutes to get organised. And in that time, Hibs had 5-6 corners. Every single one looked like it could have caused trouble. They had a few shots on goal. You know, the overall XG for the game was awful. It was like 1.9 to Hibs to 0.5 for Celtic. I mean, you know, we did well to get out of this, because pretty much all of our chances were shots outside the box. So although there were, you know, 6 shots on target, 10 shots in total, there was really none from what I'd call the sort of danger area, like zero. And then there was like a few that were wide angle in the box that were kind of poor choices. So it wasn't great. I think that you can't be overcritical, because some of these kids, I think, you know, and we'll maybe come on to some of the individual performances in a minute, but I think there's perhaps certainly one that I would pick up on. But playing without a striker, that is what it's like. That was a great example of, you know, you can play a false nine system if that false nine is messy. That will work, right? But when that false nine is a little skinny kid who honestly looks like he needs help, you know, wiping his nose, then it's not gonna work. And you're not gonna get the runs made. You're not gonna get the contact in the box. You're not gonna get people moving the defenders out of position. There was just any basic competent striker would have been able to do. And that was the most glaring reason, I think, that Celtic had such little attacking threat in the game.
Yeah, well, one of the things to think about when it comes to this game as well is that you don't want to be overly harsh on the players who are out there, because even though it is a fairly okay team, not the best team that you can obviously put out, the team that would have been preparing for Hibernian for the game would have been preparing in a system in Dubai. So all of these players were sort of just throwing onto the pitch, and it was, okay, you're playing this system, you need to work this out by yourself, which seems like a theme throughout the season, even when they do have time to prepare. James, what did you think of the game?
Yeah, it was an eyesore, basically. That's what I think of the game. It was brutal to watch. But yeah, for someone like Cameron Harper, shout out to another American making their debut for Celtic. For him to be making his debut under these circumstances, with playing a role that, you know, again, I don't even know what the role was. I looked at his heat map just out of curiosity, and it's all over the place. Everywhere from the corners to on both sides of the pitch, you know, again, so maybe moved around, maybe it was a fluid system. I don't know. And so that's just brutal. I mean, what a difficult situation to walk into. I mean, if he was the nominal striker or one of the two nominal strikers, I mean, you could kind of see at times maybe 4-2-3-1 with Turnbull out wide at times and Harper kind of a striker, maybe sort of. So, I mean, that's just brutal. And so the one thing I did want to say is I thought Welsh, you know, I'm still skeptical on Welsh. I don't think he really profiles as a European level Celtic center back. You know, I think given his size, you know, I'm a little skeptical on that. But I thought he was excellent. I thought for the circumstances, he really played a really good game. And even Duffy up until the free kick, I thought Duffy for him.
It was his best game, yeah.
Yeah, I thought Duffy was okay. I mean, it was really unfortunate. That's the free kick. My favorite proxy for the free kick was Laxalt. I've watched the free kick, I don't know, maybe half a dozen times. And the comedy value of just focusing on Laxalt's pretty high if anyone wants to try it. I mean, he kind of marks a guy and until the ball gets kicked, and then he just runs around. Like, he literally just runs around like a puppy does. you know, kind of incoherently, not really knowing what they're doing. It's amazing. And you know, obviously we had the three of them go to the line instead of coming out to cover Nisbet. So, in a really tough spot against maybe the fourth or fifth best team in the league, you know, trying to play a system with guys that haven't played together. I mean, that's the other thing, I think, fitness wise. I mean, these younger players haven't had a season. I mean, they're in training, but they're not match fit. They've mm-hmm. barely been playing. Yeah. Or if they've been playing, it's some kind of internal bounce games or something, theoretically. I mean, there's barely
I think there's been two maybe reserve games or Glasgow Cup games, possibly. I mean, Harper had cramp in 57 minutes. Now, a cramp isn't an injury. It's a conditioning failure, actually. It's a failure to condition properly. And listen, he's a kid. I mean, he wasn't physically ready to play that game. And it was astonishing because Okoflex came on, who looked quick, mobile, strong, held the ball up quite well, went into challenges. And you sort of think, who made that decision that, you know, Harper should start over Okoflex? That in itself is a stunning decision on that basis.
I really wish I had my Photoshop skills ready at the ready when I saw the pictures appearing of him wearing his AirPods and just listening to us Harper on about shape and, you know, I don't think that's what he was. I think it was Neil Lennon, apparently, he was listening to when he was going on. But in terms of this game, like, I mean, there's a big difference between match fitness and training. Anybody who has played any sport or football in particular will know that you can be as fit as a fiddle and you go onto a pitch and you're blowing within 10, 15 minutes because it's a different kind of conditioning. You're constantly up and down, raising, lowering your heart rate all the time. In terms of, you mentioned Welsh there, Alan, any particular standout performances for you?
Yeah, I think James absolutely spot on with Welsh. I like Welsh. I like him. So in terms of the game, just to put into context, you know, what is a good performance look like for him? He made 10 successful challenges, intercepts, and only lost one. Duffy actually won all of his challenges. It was easily Duffy's best game until that moment at the end. Welsh had 19 recoveries, which is second only to Sorrow. He made eight clearances, which is easily the most in the team. Making a clearance isn't necessarily a positive, but what it indicates to me is it backs up my sort of qualitative assessment of Welsh, which is that he's an uncomplicated defender. He doesn't overcomplicate the game like Duffy does. He keeps the game very simple. He plays it safe. It's something that Kieran Tierney always did. People don't focus on Tierney's defensive skills so much, but Tierney's main asset as a defender, apart from his recovery pace, was that he didn't overcomplicate the game. He kept it very simple. And as a result, he made very few errors. And Welsh similarly. And actually, you know, also the Hibs put a lot of pressure on him. You know, their default ball was the diagonal to him in Frimpong's position, which a lot of teams do. And they had, and he was up against Nisbet, who is the highest scoring striker in the league, right? And it was a really good prospect. So I think that was a standout performance from Welsh. And as I say, because of the both the qualitative and to a lesser extent the quantitative, which we don't have a lot of data on him, I'm actually quite hopeful about Welsh. And in fact, for me, if we play the rest of the season, given that Julien isn't going to be back, if we play the rest of the season with a combination of Welsh and Ayer, I'd be pretty excited to see that, actually.
We might need to get used to playing Welsh there anyway, because, I mean, Duffy is essentially gone, and maybe Chris Julien has played his last game in a Celtic kit because of, well, firstly, he's out for at least a couple of months with his knee injury, and then sure, who knows what happens after that.
So just on, sorry, I don't go backwards, but if I was Chris Julien, and I'd be really surprised if he's not taking legal advice at this time. I'd be very surprised.
Well, that is something that could potentially happen, because, I mean, it's the decision making off the board. Maybe he didn't approve of going, but I mean, it complicates the whole matter that he, you know, in personal choice, you can choose not to go, you can choose to leave early like Duffy did, essentially. But James, anything for you from this game that you want to touch on in terms of the stats, the XG, whatever?
Yeah, the other part, you know, this comes back to the coaching question. And, you know, I think the game on Monday was more so an opportunity issue. I mean, that we didn't get into positions. It's not like I didn't think the decision-making was terrible like it had been in the derby, where people were shooting and passing up good opportunities to pass. I think these were more desperation shots because that's about all we could get. but, you know, it goes back to, you know, the, for example, Soro had a shot that was actually a pretty good shot from range. That was the one thing. If you look at the, you know, we'll say the post shot XG of the long distance shooting, we actually were pretty good shooting from distance in this game. So we put an unusual number on goal and actually, you know, made their keeper make some saves. But if you look at somebody like Soro, this is where I get concerned about philosophy and coaching. You look at a player like Soro's track record prior to Celtic, I don't think he had scored a goal in
one goal.
Was it one? Yeah.
And
his number of shots were very low. He's a defensive midfielder. He plays fairly deep, and his job is not to shoot. And I can see him, and particularly the way he reacted to scoring that goal, and the dynamic between him and Lennon, I could envision a conversation where they've been encouraging him to shoot more. And maybe he's the greatest long range shooter in the history of the world, but why has no one identified this before now?
At four different clubs and four different countries and four different languages, no one thought to think,
right. So, you know, almost the, you know, it's like someone who's starts gambling for the first time. Or you see this in, you know, people that get involved in financial markets, trading stocks or something like that, or currencies. One of the worst things you can do is make a lot of money early, because then you think you know what you're doing instead of it having been luck or randomness, and you lose everything. So, you know, the fact that Soro has scored on a long range shot, and now the second one, which was a good shot. I mean, he put it, it required a good save. It looked like it was going in. You know, I shudder when I see this. I'm like, oh, you know, are we going to start seeing Soro shooting three times from 30 yards every game and encouraged to do so, which, you know, again, probably wouldn't be a good idea. So that was the other thing that struck me is in coming out of that game was I saw him shoot again. I was like, oh, boy, we don't want to see this become a pattern.
Yeah. Let's move on to the big picture things then, because we've spoken about a lot about what could have happened, what potentially might have been the fallout from the Dubai trip. The realistic, real life fallout from this is that Celtic had to play with a depleted squad. They drew against Hibs. essentially, if they wanted to win the league, they had to win every single game from now until the end of the season. That didn't happen, so they're not going to win the league. Rangers are going to win the league. So we'll put that to bed. But it's been 10 years. It's been a decade. We've spoken a lot about the sort of long-term regression of this Celtic team in Europe. What about domestically? What are we expecting from Celtic over the next 3, 4, 5 years? Because you mentioned the financial impact and what Peter Lawl is thinking of. Celtic, I actually looked at the books when they were published. 70 million in profit last year. That's depleted now. It's only a couple of hundred thousand. So it's a 70 million hit that Celtic have taken. They have a lot of assets that will be worth a lot less next year. Considerably a lot less next year, and considerably a lot less than they were last year because of the way that the market has fallen over the last year. So, Alan, your thoughts on the next couple of, or James, I think you want to jump in here.
I just wanted to throw, because there was a, and I had commented on this Twitter this week, was the Dembele move to Madrid, Atletico, and the terms of that were a loan with an option to buy. And if you looked at the rumor mill back in, I think it was September and October, about what Milan was looking to do with Ayer, was a loan with an option to buy. And if you could, you know, think about this in consumer terms, it's almost like a seller financing scheme. You know, it's like going to buy a car and them offering you a loan to buy something that you can't afford up front. I mean, you can't pay cash for it. And given what's going on and you know, this second round with the new variant of the virus, and what this might mean as we head into the end of the season, if leagues can finish, and what it looks like for early next season, and I talked about this last week, the risks here in the transfer market are substantial. That, you know, who knows what the terms are going to be when we look to sell some of these players. And, you know, given the asymmetry of the risk-reward decision-making that we talked about at the beginning of the show, whatever future plans are in the pipeline, you know, they're being laid out by the people that have been making these decisions. So when I look at the next 3 to 5 years, it's a question of, you know, model, what's the structure, and then who are the people deploying it? And then what are the, you know, just the financial resources. And I think the ultimate result of this season, we're going to come out of it with, at best, financial parity with Rangers. So we've gone in a period of 12 months from, you know, close to 40 million on the balance sheet, and you could argue upwards of 80 million plus in players, to the cash gone, and the news broke this morning my time, of the furloughing of the under 18s, you know, they put in a $13 million line of credit. I would be surprised if they're going to tap into that now with what's going on, if they don't sell anyone in this window. And we have all this risk of, you know, the issues with the support and season ticket renewals, and whether people are going to get in the grounds next season. What's the value proposition there? So I suspect Rangers aren't going to have a problem if they win the league, which, as you said, it's, you know, probably 99% probable now. And they have a fair crack at Champions League money now as well. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a complete reset in the financial landscape on a competitive basis. And this has all been done in 12 months. And a lot of it has been due to bad decision-making at Celtic, as well as, you know, again, in fairness, the Rangers on the footballing side, some better decision-making.
Yeah.
So the next 3 to 5 years is back to the future, you know, back to a league where, you know, I would be surprised if we go into next season as favorites. In fact, I would think we'll probably be fairly significant underdogs in a two-team league effectively. And there's a chance that our wage budget, and unless we get cap outside capital, you know, unless somebody's going to pony up a check in a share offering or something like that, it wouldn't surprise me if we have a smaller wage bill than Rangers, and that we go towards a youth movement. And, you know, who knows who the director of football, when they go to that model, is going to be, as it's rumored to be, it's going to happen. And who's the manager that comes in? I mean, there's just so many moving parts now. Whereas we're in relative chaos, whereas, you know, on the other side of the city, I see a plan. I see a plan being executed. And, you know, they gambled financially, but sometimes, you know, that pays off, and it looks like it may in this instance.
Yeah, and just on that, because Rangers, it's a basic money principle, a basic gambling principle, is essentially you have to spend money to make money, and Celtic have not spent money over the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years. And I've spoken about this before. They didn't, for me, do their risk reward strategy correctly if they thought that not spending money would be enough to stay in the Champions League. And ultimately, that's where clubs are making their money. That's why the super clubs are remaining the super clubs. And that's why everyone playing in the Champions League are doing better than everyone else, because the money involved in that is astronomical. And Celtic didn't think about that. They didn't think that maybe if we don't invest in the squad properly, that we won't be in this competition forever, and that money will not be there forever. And who knows the next time Celtic are going to be back in the Champions League. And to get there, you need to spend money. And to spend money, you need to have a little bit of money. And Celtic don't have any money anymore. That's where we're at.
I sort of task myself with thinking about the question, you know, is this the end of an era? Is this like the end of Celtic's sort of dynasty and hegemony over Scottish football? You know, is this strategically actually the end of that period? And I think if you think about all the scenarios about why do football club hegemonies end, Celtic don't fit any of those models. So if you look at, for example, some teams just get old together. You know, the team physically ages and declines. You know, Manchester United were a classic example of that in the early 1970s, where the European Cup winning team from 68 all got old together, Charlton and Law and so forth. And they ended up getting relegated by 1974. Barcelona are going through that exactly same time. They gave long contracts to the likes of, you know, Piqué and Busquets and so forth, and they've now got aging players in key positions that they can't ship. They've got no resale value. And then you think about other scenarios. You know, have we done a Leeds in 74 and brought in a Clough? I mean, whatever you might say about Lennon, you know, he did win. He has won four, you know, three trophies, and he, you know, he's hardly a stretch for the club culturally. He's not like, you know, Souness at Liverpool in 91, who completely destroyed everything that had been built up over the last 15 years. You could argue, you know, Van Gaal at Man United was just a complete cultural misstep. You know, we've not had sudden disaster, you know, Busby Bates, the Torino team of 49. We've not had like a key person suddenly, you know, leave. We don't have any one key person risk. So if you think about, you know, Ferguson leaving Manchester United, that's irrecoverable almost. James will be able to speak to American sport, but that's the key risk in most American sports. NBA teams are obviously very small, right? When the best player retires, the dynasty tends to end. Mm-hmm. In football, in American football, when the quarterback retires, you know, the good run comes to an end. I don't know about baseball because I don't count that as a sport. You know, I think we will see a bit of an exodus, but it's not like, you know, these teams that are built up that are excellent and then suddenly all the players leave at the same time. It happened to Everton in the 1980s. It happened to Ajax in the mid 90s. It happened to Porto when Mourinho left. We're not in that scenario either. We're not even overreaching, to your point. You know, we're not doing a Leeds United. We're not doing a Rangers under Murray. So what this is actually a story of underreaching and of arch conservatism. One of the most, you know, frustrating things that Lowell's ever said was that piece that Phil McGillivan reported, and it was a personal conversation that he was reporting. So it was a direct quote that when the Rangers liquidation, you know, started to become reality, Lowell's response to that was, this has cost us 5 million quid a season. That was his response. Again, accountant, all he's thinking about is the bottom line. And I think there are, I think what we saw under Ronnie Dyla wasn't Dyla's fault in terms of closing that tier. I think the reality was there's probably around 5,000 season ticket holders who won't renew if they're not playing in Old Firm games. And you know what? Good riddance to them, as far as I'm concerned. You know, what I've never understood about this is, for me, and you mentioned it, Enda, about the Champions League money. Surely, I get that Celtic would be 5 million a year poorer by not having a Rangers around to compete against and the Old Firm dollar, etc. But surely having a free run at Champions League money for all those years would make up for that more. What I think has happened is typical Lowell. He wants his cake and he wants to eat it. He wanted depressed, subjugated Rangers to keep those 5,000 people renewing the season tickets, to get that 5 million extra in TV money. Andy thought he was going to get a free run at the Champions League money, but they haven't actually set themselves up to do that. And perhaps it's taken them by surprise that the lot across the city have gambled to such an extent as they have. And I kind of slightly disagree with James on that one, because they are absolutely built on sand. Mm. And, you know, there has to be a reckoning. At some point, there has to be a reckoning. But that, nevertheless, we have dropped the ball. And I think if it is an end of an era, it's not for the reasons that normally football clubs come to the end of their dominance. It's actually the opposite of many of those reasons.
There might be a reckoning for them. Like, it could come in the same form as it came last time. Or it could, like James say, it could work out for them, because basically what football clubs build themselves on, what the Manchester United model has been for years now under the Glazers, and even some the Liverpool model to an extent, has been built on waging debt on
highly leveraged,
leveraging that debt and bringing in money later on. And that's what Rangers are essentially promising. If we spend all this money, Champions League will be there for us over the next couple of years, and we will be able to pay that back.
So I'll use a financial world analogy here. So the difference with Rangers this time is, you know, they're more analogous to a country like the United States that's issuing their own debt in their own currency. So all of their debt, for the most part, is internally held. They have, you know, they've been converting it. So that's why, and I didn't quite understand the dynamics of this back in the spring until I really looked into it. Again, looking for things to do during lockdown. So I kind of changed my view on their path financially at that point, because, you know, they're going to be able to endow their financial situation by making Champions League. And, you know, again, they do have valuable players. They're not as valuable as an Edouard or theoretically a McGregor, although after the season, who knows. But, you know, they're going to be able to get a decent price for Barisic and even Tavernier. I mean, they probably should look to sell him after the season, given his age and decline profile and the kind of season that he's had. So, you know, if they get 30 million from Champions League and they can raise another 20 or 25 million in selling players, again, I've looked at their financial statements. That's enough. That's enough for them to basically get to the point of being a going concern, an operating model where they're not having to finance externally. And that's the difference. When you're in Argentina and you have to borrow money in U.S. dollars, you know, that's the analogous of what happened to Rangers back in the noughts, which is they borrowed money from banks. And that's, you know, when you have creditors that are going to assert creditor powers, then that's where you come into a problem. But they simply don't have that dynamic. So again, that's where the irony of all this is. You know, we may come out of this and it could be Celtic with the one that's drawn a bank line. This is what I'm saying. The degree of this, it's like bizarro world in 12 months, just turning this, flipping it completely upside down. And so again, I suspect what Celtic's board is expecting is that they're going to be able to raise enough through player sales to basically bail them out. And that's why I keep coming back to this. Well, yeah, they're going to be able to sell them, but boy, I tell you, if I was somebody looking to buy Celtic players right now, I would be drooling. I would be drooling at my negotiating leverage as this is going into, you know, the last 18 months of the Big Four.
Yeah, no, it makes sense, James. I don't disagree with any of that, but it does work both ways, right? I mean, Celtic are still relatively a large club, and that works both ways in terms of their dealings with smaller clubs, unfortunately. So, but I take your point. I mean, in terms of the impact on the bottom line, in terms of bringing money in and financing a rebuild, which is, I mean, listen, a rebuild is on the cards because I don't think we'll keep any of the loan players, frankly. And, it's likely that the likes of Incham, probably Edouard, probably Christie, probably Ayer even, are going to be, from a career development perspective, looking to be on their way. And that leaves you with a core, right? A core of, I'm going to say Barkas because he's an experienced goalkeeper, Julian, Turnbull, McGregor, Forrest. That's you've got to build a skeleton around that. Now, there are some promising young players there, Frimpong, Taylor's only 23, Johnson's 21, Sorrow's 22, Klamala's only 22, Ajeti's only 23, believe it or not. So there's a core of younger players there, but you're going to need, 6-7 experienced players to mm-hmm. trade in to get back to a solid level. So yeah, it's going to be a tough ask.
Well, and that's the issue is the structure. That's what I said earlier. The structure and the people deploying the plan here, as far as what's this rebuild going to look like, and what's the model. And that all of that introduces significant risk, whereas it looks like Rangers have already done that. They already have their model. They already have Wilson in place. They're already kind of a well-oiled machine to a degree, whereas we're kind of in the reconstitution phase. And it might happen. I mean, from the ashes, right, rises the phoenix. So we're certainly burning it down. But that introduces risk. So if they make good decisions from here, put smart people in control and have a vision and a model and move forward from there, there will be resources. I'm not mm-hmm. saying there won't be resources, but it's an issue of the margin for error and the risk, back to this conversation of risk. You're introducing risk and the resources aren't going to be as high as they should have been. Certainly, probably a large degree smaller than they expected, how this would all play out. That's why I go back. If you think about the next 3 to 5 years, it's very dicey. I think mm-hmm. there's the call it the expected value range, so I could see things working out great. Rangers are going to have some disruption when Gerard eventually leaves. And there's risk then when that happens.
If he takes Beal with him, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And maybe Wilson gets a better job somewhere, gets attracted somewhere, so there's obviously bilateral risk here. It's just that right now, particularly over the next 2 years, it looks like, Celtic's facing a lot more. And that means there could be upside there if things break right, but it could also get really bad if they don't make good decisions, mm-hmm. which again, this goes back to why the last 12 months are so concerning, as we've kind of spiraled into so many bad decisions.
I'm going to finish this off with another phrase, sort of like your Phoenix phrase, James.
Yes.
Through adversity comes opportunity. And if Celtic can get, as you said, there's a long shot, if they can get right people in the right frame of mind that know what they're doing, a football director, I think, is absolutely key to all of this. Not that it's going to solve all the problems, but I do think it will be getting a person in there that knows the footballing world makes a lot bigger difference when it's changing from Peter Lawl making football decisions to a football person who understands the market and understands the game making the decision. So hopefully, and we will do a podcast on what is going to happen and what players are leaving and all those kind of things. We'll touch on that in a little bit more depth as the week goes on. Before we finish up, I do want to say I did say that there was exciting news coming for the Huddle Breakdown podcast. We are joining the 20 Minute Tims podcast on their Patreon page once a month, every month for the next 6 months until the end of the season. We'll have a podcast on their Patreon page anyway. So that is the news. We'll announce it on social media as well. So thanks to everyone who has listened to this point so far. And if you want to join and listen to us on the 20 Minute Tims Patreon, you can sign up to their Patreon page as well. Until next week, until the next time we have to deal with another Celtic crisis, Juco James and Alan Morrison, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
We'll chat to you later.